large portfolio, and the slice of the liens that we're talking about today is a small percentage of our portfolio. We have responsibility for the entire life cycle of the liens, from recording the assessment to billing property owners and collecting the money owed. Okay, so the next slide, I think we're caught up.
So the $13 million recovered to date is recovered from foreclosure sales?
It's from the collections effort for cases that have come into the foreclosure program. So once traditional collection efforts have been exhausted by the Revenue Bureau, the cases are transferred back into our office to the foreclosure program, and Marco engages on all kinds of collections efforts to try to turn those properties over or to bring those accounts into compliance with their payments.
That's a very successful collections effort.
That's correct.
And I appreciate it very much, but I think it's important to be clear. When was the last time we foreclosed on a house?
1971.
The city foreclosed in 1971.
So one policy choice for us as a city is to tell our auditor and our auditor staff, you have this council's backing in foreclosing on distressed properties, that we will take the political heat, if any, for foreclosing on properties owned by Wall Street banks that are derelicts and nuisances in our neighborhoods. I don't think that's a big political risk, frankly, for us to intervene and use the authority that you have. But we have not foreclosed on a house in over 40 years.
Yeah, you are correct on that. The reason why we have achieved the 75% in our recovery is that when we get to that point, case in point right now, all those houses, a couple of them have already contacted us when we got into them. And so they, when you get to point of foreclosing, they come and pay us. But that doesn't really, right now, that's what I'm saying. When we, the expense that we have had, as we get to that point, they will pay. And that tool is not going to be available anymore to get the property back into the market as it is. And it's a constant that, you know how they manipulate the market.
Very capably managed negotiation program.
Right.
That's one of, negotiation is one of the options.
Right, and that's what we do.
Okay, so the limitations of the code, the city code that we adhere to, Title V, Chapter 30, which is the collections and foreclosure process, limit us to focusing our efforts on the collection of liens, including foreclosure when necessary. That portion of the code is not intended to enforce property maintenance regulations, and I think it will require quite a bit more collaboration and communication with development services and with the other bureaus we work with to close the gap and to do to move us towards what Mike Liefeld suggested should be an enforcement arm of the foreclosure program as opposed to just being a collections mechanism. We're ready and willing to start working on that right away, and we have the collections committee getting ready to meet next week to start that process. I want to go through a little bit of what our recovery looks like, because it is not a traditional collections method. We're focused on recovering costs to the city in a way that's transparent and fair to property owners. And I don't know if you can get that back up, but there is a purpose and authority slide that has the direction for the auditor's office on when and how foreclosure should be used. As Marco said, in our experience, most lien accounts resolve themselves far short of foreclosure. They become current in their payments, receive waivers or reductions from the bureaus, or the property is sold. So most times foreclosure is not a necessary step, but the specter of foreclosure can be a tool to bring property owners into compliance with their payments. The seizure of property is one of the most controversial and drastic actions a government can take, and for this reason, the auditor's office considers foreclosure only in the most egregious and necessary cases, such as those that BDS identified in the distressed and vacant properties list that it provided us. There is a, believe it or not, very simplified flowchart of the foreclosure process on the next slide. I'll try to quickly walk you through the process. Once an account becomes delinquent and has gone through standard collection attempts by the Revenue Bureau, it's transferred to the foreclosure program. The foreclosure manager contacts the property owner in writing, emphasizing the gravity of the situation and the ramifications of inaction. The notice specifies that the property will be placed on the foreclosure list unless the owner elects to pay under a payment plan or brings the account current. If the owner is responsive, a payment plan is drafted, and as long as payments are made, okay, the account is out of delinquent status and no longer at risk of foreclosure. It's important to note that a property owner may be current on lien payments and therefore have an account in good status without necessarily having ever addressed the underlying problems with the property. So that's one of the major limitations of the foreclosure process as a solution for severely distressed properties. Marco's approach and our office's approach to collections is a little different than traditional collections agencies. Many owners are unable to care for their properties. They're also the most vulnerable among us: the elderly, those with mental and physical health challenges, veterans, and those who can no longer take care of their financial affairs for other reasons. In many cases, the foreclosure manager acts as a social worker, attempting to match property owners with social, community, government, and family resources that can help them resolve the issues with their properties. And we've developed a network of agencies and institutions that includes Adult Protective Services, Legal Aid, Elders in Action, and others. So communication paired with the potential of property foreclosure are the most powerful tools that our office uses. Sorry, I'm cutting in and out. A plan that's satisfactory to both the city and the property owners developed, and we have achieved results by providing counseling and guidance to property owners together with efforts to collect. Okay, so back to the flow chart. If efforts to work with property owners are not effective, staff will consider moving forward with foreclosure. Individual case files developed for each delinquent account that includes a history of the problems with the property and efforts at collection. The foreclosure manager uses this information to make recommendations on whether to potentially revise the lien amount and payment terms. And these recommendations are then submitted to the collections committee for a decision. City code charges the collections committee specifically with the responsibility of accepting, revising, or rejecting the auditor's recommendations on what is essentially a last best offer before the property is placed on the foreclosure list for council vote. Any adjustments to the payment amount must take into account other violations, history of cooperation, the owner's financial circumstances, the scale of the violation, whether it's repeated or intentional, and other mitigating or aggravating factors. The collections committee itself is comprised of four staff members, representative from two members of the City Council, one from the Bureau of Development Services, and one from the Office of Management and Finance. Once the committee has reached a decision, the property owner is notified in writing and has 30 days to take action. If the owner accepts the committee's determination, the process starts over again with drafting a payment plan. Otherwise, the owner can then appeal the determination to the hearings officer if the case has not already been to the hearings officer. If the owner rejects the committee's determination, or the case has already been to the hearings office, or the case goes to the hearings office and the determination of the collections committee is upheld, the case will be included in the foreclosure list to council. Okay. And as Marco mentioned and I mentioned, we've periodically convened the collections committee, and in our experience, this process has produced good results in that it pressures owners into taking action. The majority of cases we consider for foreclosure resolve as the case files are being developed or the property owner accepts the adjustment in payments and gets into compliance on their accounts, whether or not they actually resolve the underlying issues with the property. Council's responsibility. The next step is to submit the list to council, which votes on properties to include in the foreclosure list and which properties, if any, the city has an interest to purchase. The council clerk then transmits the foreclosure list to the treasurer. The treasurer has a long list of responsibilities to bring foreclosure to fruition, including implementation of the sale, management of the redemption process, and issuance of deed. Because we've not foreclosed on a property for so long, this will be a new process for the treasurer, and so rules and procedures will have to be developed, and I imagine there will be some impact on her workload. It's also important to mention that even after a sale is conducted, the property owner has a one-year redemption period in which they or anyone with a recorded interest in the property can redeem the property by payment in full of their lien and costs. This puts a significant delay in getting the property into more productive use, but it's important to protect property owner rights. Once the redemption period expires, the treasurer will execute a deed conveying the foreclosed property.
Is the one-year redemption period code or statute?
It's state statute that we have also copied into code.
Based on 223, which is state statute.
Say again, Mark.
We try to mirror our code on state statute 223, and so they require to have the redemption period.
So can I just ask a kind of, I guess, obvious question then. If you have a successful foreclosure, but someone has a one-year redemption period, doesn't that effectively prevent anyone from improving the property for the 1 year, since the redemption period would allow that person to acquire the property at their existing basis?
I think Zach will be prepared to talk about that when we talk about receivership as an option.
Yeah, not necessarily, because what can happen, just to conclude here for Mr. Fish, is that during that period, nothing precludes the person who has the certificate to this then or still property owner. So they can get into an agreement or sign a contract.
Whatever.
Right.
So let me again make sure, because I've been learning on this issue all along over the last year or two, but I want to make sure no one feels criticized for the work they're doing now, just as I was at BDS. You're doing a great job. In fact, if we're in the private sector, we should be paying you a bonus because you're bringing in $1 million a year, right? But this program, as it's been managed since the 1970s, before any of us started work here, since Dan Saltzman was born, this program since the 1970s, particularly during Marco's tenure here, is doing a really good job of getting the city paid. That's what this program does, is it makes the city more whole by getting liens paid. But what it doesn't do is take care of these egregious neighborhood nuisances. So now, as Sarah described, there's better communication starting to happen between our bureaus, because a big part of the problem here is multiple bureaus involved. So let me put this to you. You've got a list now of 25 extremely distressed, vacant, abandoned houses. Based on what you know so far, is there any reason not to foreclose on those houses?
Well, the first four that Marco has looked at, three of those have come in to make payments on their liens.
Are they fully paid?
They are not fully paid, but they are in compliance with making payments on their liens, and they've had discussions with him about coming into compliance with the proper underlying property issues. One of them has sold. So this has been our experience for many years. By the time that we get with properties to the point where we're looking at foreclosure, the pressure starts to increase on those owners,
right,
and it is effective at getting them to take some action.
So Sally put up with a situation like this for 6 years. What do you think will happen to the speed of property owner response when you bring the first foreclosure ordinance to the city council in 45 years?
I hope it will speed up, but there's no guarantee that the property owner won't come in and start making payments on the lien, because that may be cheaper.
And if they cure the defects in the property and put it in habitable condition and rent it to somebody or sell it to somebody, that's great. The goal here is not for the city to own real estate. The goal is for us to take advantage of market conditions to get banks that are sitting on properties and not caring about the side effects on Portland neighborhoods to have a different set of financial signals than we're giving them today. And I think, my personal opinion, and we'll get it, the question is, do we foreclose or do we put them into receivership? And that's what Zach will talk about next. Once we bring that hammer down, in a market where you can sell your property for more than it's worth if you've owned it for more than 6 months, people will act. People are rational. It's just that they're also, in some cases, rational and completely uncaring about the side effects of their ownership.
When we are in complete agreement, and we have been during this conversation, a discussion that we are having, the fact is that if we don't use all the tools that we have at our disposal, using only one, push to one side. So we need to find a way where we put all of those tools synchronized, that we squeeze them in the center. The banks being one example, for example, we can locate, like Zach mentioned, many of the property owners we can locate, because the servicing company who is working for the bank is behind. So we try to reach everything that you look at the county, is in John Doe's name. John Doe is not there for 10 years. So until we get to find out, we need to come up with a tool where we can force the banks to, if you did foreclose on this property at a certain date, the city of Portland, you have to have so many days when you have to convey that property to your name. Once you convey to their name, so it's much easier for us to foreclose, because we know who to go after, and then the city, using the other tools that we have, okay, 30 days, you have to convey your name. On that 30 days, BDS can start the process of having a code against the property. That opened the door for us in foreclosure to open, to go after them. Or there are properties like Zach probably going to mention later on, where receivership is another tool. And in the case of receivership, some of them can even be the person who is living there but cannot take care of the property and is willing to come to the city. I'm willing to
Can I just make sure I understand something? Because I, having practiced law once upon a time, I know that there's, you know, there's a whole cottage industry in this country devoted to evading paying bills and using the legal tools. And so at the 11th hour under our current system, someone can theoretically come in and make a deal and agree to do a payment schedule. And so, and that's where you've been quite successful in recovering money. So that's what can happen at the 11th hour. Also at the 11th hour, someone can file for bankruptcy, right? And get a stay and put a halt to the whole proceeding. So those are at least two options. And then, Sarah, in terms of what you said earlier about like older adults who can't maintain their homes and you bring in Elders in Action and everything else, do we also coordinate with the utilities to make sure those individuals are getting or eligible and receiving the discount programs that the city has for low-income homeowners? Does that, is there a automatic referral so that while you're trying to stabilize the homeowner, we're making sure they're qualifying for any discount programs?
Mostly used is Elders in Action. And so when they go there, they try to make this coordination because there are instances where they cannot take care of their affairs anymore, even paying for their utilities and things like. And that's when we use someone like an institution like Elders in Action.
But Chad mentioned this earlier, and I want to reiterate this. This is a whole bunch of very complex issues here.
Right.
They get even more complex when the owner is still entitled to the house, thus the bankruptcy scenario, or when there's someone still living in the house. Those aren't the houses we're talking about today. We're talking about the house that no one has legitimately lived in for years and where the legal owner who's on the title has long since relinquished interest. So their bankruptcy or non-bankruptcy is no longer an issue. That bank owns that house.
That's correct.
In all but title in some cases, or in title in other cases. But we're talking about a distant bank, not a bereaved home buyer who is the other party here.
And just to emphasize this aspect that you brought up, is another thing that we have when it comes to us to prevent what happened in 1971. We go and look at each one of them separately because you don't want to dislike someone that is there who is not capable of taking care of their own affairs.
We got spooked by in the 1970s was the prospect that we would kick grandma out of the house and foreclose on it. That's not what we're talking about here. Grandma or whoever was in that house is long gone. There have been squatters in there three times. We're spending, you know, again, you're doing a great job bringing in $1 million a year. We're spending far more than $1 million a year in police work alone, not to mention crime prevention, not to mention BDS, not to mention Fire Bureau. This, I want to really keep our focus on these most egregious houses because those are the ones that we can act most decisively on, and they're the ones that are having the worst problems.
I think it's really important that BDS continue to bring these to our attention because we are, you know, essentially in the office. It's a paper exercise and conversations on the phone, and so we don't have police reports coming across our desk that tell us which of these properties need the most attention. So this is a great opportunity for us to collaborate on that because we are perfectly willing to go through with the foreclosure, but we need to know that A, we have the support to do so and that we have the right kinds of properties that that will be the biggest benefit to the bureaus and to the community when they're actually foreclosed.
Great. And also, like you mentioned, that I appreciate the fact that you said this council is behind the effort because if you don't have the council behind the effort, you have been here before.
Yeah,
you
should not put you or the auditor in that position. That should be something we take on collectively. Uh-huh. I want to get you two to wrap up and thank
Absolutely.
You because we want to bring the next panel up and then have all of you available for discussion.
We do have to come with some code changes before we can go through with the foreclosure. They are just to bring the city code into alignment with some changes in state law. They have to do with a definition of the sales price. the number of bids or the type of bids that we can receive, and they direct the treasurer to implement the foreclosure process in compliance with the new sales price.
You're bringing those ordinance changes forward?
Yeah, we'll do that in the next month or two.
Okay, great.
Cases to the committee. They already have the.
Excellent.
So we are moving.
It's a matter of. Well, great work. Thank you both.
Wait, before you leave, there was a slide you skipped over. So the collections committee is going to meet on April 13th
right,
to
next
review
week.
The 25 properties that are extremely
the first three properties. Yeah, it's a very time consuming process for Marco to put the case files together. So we've got three for them to be looking at next week.
Okay. And I guess just maybe we can ask this in the bigger discussion. Is there something to be said, since we're having so much trouble fleshing out owners, to foreclose first and ask questions later? Let them find us.
He's finding the owners.
Okay.
He's finding the owners.
Well, we're finding owners, but they're not doing anything until the foreclosure. Yeah. So that's what that's what I mean, is foreclose first, let them come up and settle their accounts.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe. Or notice of foreclosure.
We have a process that we have to follow. Yeah. So we have, and that's what we are doing. We are following our process, and sometimes in the course of doing that, they come and pay, but doesn't mean that the problem with the house has been taken care of.
Thanks.
I'm here to talk about both the foreclosure issue, but also the receivership idea, and that is Zach Klonowski again, Simon Wong from City Attorney's Office, and Diane Lynn from Proud Ground. You're going to stay there, Simon, or you can come up here if you want, whichever.
I'm comfortable here.
Okay. It's comfortable in that spot. So we appreciate.
Can somebody define receivership?
Yes, I will take that on. I'm very glad to see the conversation that we're having, and that receivership has come up as a possible tool that we already have in city code to deal with some of these houses. And the key thing is to address the underlying nuisance that is plaguing these properties, and that's what the receivership tool really does, which is why it's an effective tool, and it's been used in other cities to great effect. So what receivership is the law allows property owners to be sued for code violations and lose their homes if they fail to make repairs. So what it is, it's a legal means to eliminate a public nuisance. For the lawyers among us, it functions similar to injunctive relief in that it provides equitable relief through a court order and appointment of a receiver to abate a property nuisance. It's a very aggressive and effective tool for dealing with absentee property owners who have let a property fall into disrepair. It provides an expedited process for nuisance abatement. Abatement can begin in a matter of months, whereas with foreclosure, we've seen it can take anywhere from 12 to 24 months, and that's a good situation. It can take a decade even, as we've seen through testimony today. And then, as I mentioned earlier, it's proven very effective in other cities, most notably in Baltimore, through their Vacants to Value program. It's a little different than what we have in city code, but it's very similar and functions in pretty much the same way. And so I have the code language for the receivership program, which is in Title 29 or Chapter 29, and then also a flow chart that will walk us through the receivership process. So what triggers a receivership, or at least the authority to use a receivership? Under a property code violations that threatens the public's health, safety, or welfare. Examples that have been mentioned today: broken windows, trash and debris in the yard, rat infestation, blocked sidewalks, et cetera, et cetera. And if the owner does not act in a timely manner to correct the violation, notice can be sent to parties of the intent to petition the court to appoint a receiver. So the city attorney can petition the court to appoint a receiver. If no interested party has taken any action to foreclose their security interest within 60 days of that notice going out, the BDS director may apply for the appointment of receiver in court. From there, the court can then look at the property and deem whether it's a good candidate for receivership, which I don't think many of these properties a judge will take a second look at. They're obvious candidates. And then select a receiver. And if you look at the flow chart, there are laid out very plainly that there are four different options for selecting a receiver. It can be the Housing Authority of Portland, Home Forward, a city bureau, an urban renewal agency, or a private not-for-profit corporation, the primary purpose of which is the improvement of housing conditions within the city. So once receiver is appointed, within 30 days of appointment by the court, the receiver will submit to BDS the, the BDS director a written plan for abatement, so their plan for dealing with the underlying nuisance that is plaguing that property and makes it a good candidate for the receivership program. Then the court approves that plan, and the receiver then would begin that abatement work and put the house back into a saleable condition. And then if the costs and the obligations incurred due to the abatement have not been paid in a timely fashion, the receiver then can take an action to court to foreclose on that receivership lien. So that's the framework of the program. And what it does is it allows us to get at the underlying property nuisance and not allow the property owner at the last minute to come in and get on a payment plan and come into compliance, yet not address the underlying livability issue that is plaguing the city. And so this tool can work and complement our new, hopefully, foray into the foreclosure issue with the auditor's office. And there'll be situations where foreclosure is appropriate, and there'll be situations where receivership's appropriate. And we'll just have to do it on a case-by-case basis.
So we already have this? Is this already in code?
It's already in city code, and it's been used in the past.
When?
I think the early 2000s is what I've been told by BDS and IBM program. And so what this does is this
can force land speculators and others gaming the system by paying down liens and property taxes, but not addressing the underlying nuisance, to kind of put up or shut up. Essentially, it will allow the city to fire a property owner who is not being responsible and not taking care of the property and is paying their property taxes to avoid a county foreclosure process, but not addressing the underlying issue and then waiting for land value to go up before they make a sale. And what we've seen, which is really makes this an attractive tool, is that in 75 to 90% of cases, once the city petitions the court to appoint a receiver, at the drop of a hat, that the property owner comes in and will either restore the property and get it into a saleable condition, or will voluntarily sell the property in 75 to 90% of the cases. So even just the threat, this is in Baltimore. So
I mean, our real estate market is a little better. Baltimore's not doing badly these days, but I think real estate in Portland's a little hotter.
Yes, and so I spoke with some of the people that run the program in Baltimore, and they said this is an extremely effective tool. They can't recommend it highly enough. And the good news is it works even better in hot real estate markets, obviously, because there's more of a market. So once the information's out there, people are lining up to buy these problem properties. So that's the basic idea of the receivership program. I have Diane Lynn here from Proud Ground, who I've been talking to about potentially partnering with the city to act as receiver for dealing with these nuisance problems.
Good morning.
Am I on? Good morning. I'm Diane Lynn, Executive Director of Prague Ground. Happy to be here today. Really thrilled at the prospect of being able to at least play a role in defining how a receivership could work. It doesn't preclude any other partners from stepping up. But we have a concept that Zach and your team have approached us about, and we've submitted a proposal in rough form that really would suggest that in order to really move this process along, which you've heard today is really the tough part, you know, there's just barrier after barrier. And to get through those barriers, given our past history, my staff has worked with the team here at the city in the past. And because there's one thing after the other that comes up, there's people involved and complex legal and procedural challenges, you have to have a way to really move forward. Dots have to connect. And what we would be proposing is to step in when the city has exhausted its resources and partner with the city to help evaluate homes, see what needs to be done, go out and look at it, kind of play a role in identifying the components of a plan that could be presented to a judge, hypothetically, and that a receivership possibility would follow that. We would really build into the process, again, being able to move forward on these. The neighbors you've heard from today, the neighbors we know about in my years at the Office of Neighborhood Associations, completely remember how devastating this can be, and time is of the essence when people are living next to these properties. So we would suggest that the city really consider a way to get an outside partner to assist the city when when it's time to apply the kind of skill set that we used in the neighborhood stabilization program, the NSP program, where they were tax foreclosed properties. The federal government came in, gave us some resources to purchase those properties, renovate them all the way back up to standards, and then sell them on the market. And this program actually provides the tools to kind of make everyone whole in that process. So it gives us kind of all the components we need, as long as we're committing to, again, connecting all those dots and moving forward on the process so we can expedite for the sake of the neighborhood and the neighbors. Happy to answer any questions.
Let me just turn to Simon first, and that is, Simon, if we make the ordinance changes that Sarah described before, and given the authority that we have now for receivership, are there any other legal impediments to us starting this machinery and moving forward?
No. There are no code changes that are necessary to the receivership. All the tools are in place, legally speaking. And with respect to city code for foreclosures, state law allows foreclosure to proceed either under municipal code or under state law for a lien foreclosure. So that's already something that's available to us. But I certainly understand how city code should match up with the state code to get basically modern and to be streamlined.
So if I'm hearing your answer correct, not being a lawyer, we can start doing receivership on these 25 or so properties tomorrow?
Well, let's just be clear that we could start the process. And as you heard earlier, sometimes the threat of foreclosure and or receivership can actually result in the improvement of a property sooner than later, which is actually a better outcome as many times as possible, right?
I'd be happy for Diane's organization to end up renovating some of these houses, but I would also be happy to, like we did in an earlier chapter of this kind of issue, work you out of a job, because having these property owners fix it up first. So there's a little echo here for the two of us, because when I first took office as a city commissioner, there were 2,000 vacant and abandoned houses in North and Northeast Portland, just in North and Northeast Portland. We relied very heavily on nonprofit community development corporations, whether it was Host or Reach or others, to work their way through that inventory in a much different real estate market. So I think, you know, among the options here, who could be the receiver? Home Forward, maybe. Housing Bureau, probably not, because they've got other things to focus on. PDC, no thank you. I've got other things. I think we've all got other things we want them to focus on. Using a nonprofit or a set of nonprofits to be the receiver, to me, is the best of those four options. It's not like the public agencies couldn't do it, but they're focused on other missions, and they're not as nimble at the granular level of this house or that block as CDCs or nonprofits are.
And you would envision doing some kind of a request for proposals offer, see who's interested.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Brown's interested. Maybe there's some others that are interested. Again, some of our nonprofits are focused on much bigger projects now. You know, Reach. I was on the Reach board. Reach used to do little projects. Now they do big projects. They do great big projects. I don't know if they would be interested, but some of the nonprofits would, and some of them probably wouldn't.
And two things to note. One, the main obstacle to instituting this program would be identifying a receiver, because you can't go to the court and ask to appoint a receiver if you don't have one already identified. The second would be, this is a legal tool, and so we need to look at what the city attorney's office would need to just get this program up and running, because there is quite a bit of legal work involved.
Have we asked Home Forward about their interests?
I've reached out to a number of organizations. I reached out to Home Forward. I can't remember off the top of my head what their response was, but I can get you that information.
And is at the other end, after we fix them up, or the nonprofit has fixed them up, is there a way to keep it in affordable housing and not just sell it to the highest bidder, which is going to be some developer, which might even knock it down again?
We discussed this, Commissioner. As you can imagine, our greatest hope would be that some of these houses could, in fact, end up in an affordability portfolio of some kind. It may not be permanent. It may not be, the lowest end of the MFI spectrum. We have to be very careful that once the houses are sold at auction, which is the process you have to go through, that's done fairly and is orchestrated with all fairness, no deference to any entity. At the same time, we work with all those agencies across the city, and would want to suss out any possibility that the home actually could be in a place where additional subsidy or support could bring the house into an affordability status. And again, in the RFP process, that could be part of what we want to keep our eye on. You know, we want to keep our eye on that prize. We just can't buy it ourselves in auction as receiver. That's one thing we can't do. But we'd like to. That would be an ultimate goal, if possible.
That's what we might have to devote some of our resources.
Yeah, I figured you would have thought of that.
Of course.
The county property tax, if they default there, then doesn't government get the first option to buy county properties?
Yes. If a house is 6 years in default in terms of its Multnomah County property taxes, then Multnomah County can foreclose on the house and take possession of the house.
So have we talked to them about how urgent they could do that?
We have been talking. I understand that the mayor's team has been talking to Multnomah County with respect to how they do their foreclosures, but it's a entirely different process since it involves property taxes and it's very narrow for that purpose. So it's a little bit apples and oranges with respect to how the city would conduct, say, any foreclosure under city programs versus what the county does.
I don't understand all the legal wrinkles to this, but I think it would take a change to state law to be able to have a program similar to what the county does.
No, I wasn't suggesting. I was just what an additional level could be if we can encourage them to foreclose on some of these, then we do get to have first bite at the apple, because we've done that in parks where there's been vacant lots. We've gotten to the first right of refusal and have been able to buy some properties in natural areas, for example.
And that's a great point, but with the property tax foreclosure, it takes a 6-year period of being delinquent before I believe they're allowed to foreclose.
Well, Sally, the one next to Sally has been not doing so well for 6 years.
Yeah, except some of these owners are, again, sophisticated enough to know which bills to pay to stay just one step short of trouble. And so it would be nice.
Right, 6 years ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, I hear you, Commissioner, and I think one thing I want to note is I think I'm translating this correctly from what I'm hearing from both of my colleagues. I believe there's a strong interest not only moving forward, but in making sure that to the extent possible, the houses that come out the other end of this pipeline are made available for affordable home ownership. Now, that might require other program connections and other resources, but we have some dedicated towards affordable home ownership, at least in some parts of the city, and we could have more under our state of emergency efforts or in our next budget. So I'm very interested in connecting those dots. Again, as a former board member of a nonprofit that worked itself out of a job, Host, bought distressed properties, fixed them up, sold them to people in North and Northeast Portland with a desire of keeping people in the neighborhoods in better housing. It largely worked. In fact, it did work. It worked so well that they worked themselves out of a job because there aren't enough vacant abandoned houses in North and Northeast to keep Host going anymore, so they folded. Great. But it might take other resources partnered up with this in order to get to that outcome, since we can't have a discretionary sale at the end of the procedure process. So other questions or points on this front with this team or for any of our presenters who've walked us through all this today from either of you?
Well, I certainly appreciate having this work session. It's definitely opened my eyes to the frustrations that many people in the city feel about living next to these properties and frustrations with the processes involved because we are dealing with property rights, but I'm all for figuring out a way to make things happen quicker. And even if there's some legal risk, I think it's worth it to take the risk in order to clean up these properties and get them into constructive home ownership and affordable.
I want to thank everybody who's been here today and all of you who are working on this. This is one of the most hopeful things going on right now in city government, because this is a big, ugly, complex problem that involves multiple bureaus and tests the question of whether what we can act like one organization or whether we're a whole bunch of silos that don't talk to each other. I think what we're hearing from the folks that we've heard from today is a spirit of cooperation and of empathy that's really important. I think we all see these houses and listen to these stories, and I think we reach the same word, which is this is unacceptable. No one should have to live next to a house like this anywhere, especially in a city with a great real estate market, lots of people looking for housing, and plenty of folks that are unhoused that need a place to live. So I think all of us reach that conclusion, and what I'm hearing from the folks that that Chad and Zach have brought together is that there's a real interest in making this work. So, Auditor, thank you for you and your staff and the great work you're doing now and for the commitment to make this work. And again, there's some political cover that, I'm going to be blunt about this, we as a city council need to say to our staff, it is okay to take the political and legal risk of foreclosing on trashed out houses that are empty of legal owners, maybe occupied occasionally by squatters. It is okay to take the legal risk to foreclose or send into receivership those distressed properties. That is in the public interest. And we, you know, as we take action on the ordinance that you're going to bring forward and on the foreclosure ordinances that you bring to us, again, I don't think that's a big political risk, but let's be clear. We're the ones that take that risk. I think it's a risk very much worth taking. We will save a fortune in police costs, in BDS costs, and, to use the old MasterCard phrase, the impact on neighbors is going to be priceless. I mean, you've never counted the cost of what this has meant to you financially, but what it has meant to you psychically as a mom and as a neighbor having to live next to this, frankly, I can't imagine how bad it's been for you. So thank you for being patient, still smiling when you come here instead of spitting nails at us for being such a slow bureaucracy in responding to this crisis. But I think we can respond a lot better, and this is a really helpful piece of work. The registry program. Sorry, we left Chad out on the registry program. So come talk about that, please. Thank you both.
That's okay. So just wanted to provide a little bit of... I'll be real brief. Just wanted to provide a little bit more context, historical context. You know, as we go down our list of recommendations for you, one thing that happened back in 2012 was council visited the idea of a vacant registry program. And this was a proposal put forward. It involved the Bureau of Development Services, Bureau of Technology Services, and the Revenue Bureau. And the idea, put simply, is to really get upstream with identifying these houses as they come into our radar early on, and so that they have to be registered in a place. And so it's a consolidated list that we're all looking at. And there are some smaller municipalities that have had great success with this. I know Hillsboro, Oregon has tried this. It may or may not be the perfect fit for Portland. We have Title 29 here working for us, so that might be a reason why we don't necessarily need to explore the option of a vacant registry program, but I want to put that out there on the table as something to possibly reconsider that might complement our new work, because back in 2012, we also didn't have this nuanced of a conversation and put forth a multi-pronged approach with existing tools. And then lastly, wanted to also reemphasize our relationship with the banks. And as I go down our list of final recommendations, one of them is better collaboration internally. So Zach and I worked with our partners who are presented here today to have a meeting with a number of bank representatives a few months ago. And the meeting was very, very interesting because we got to have this kind of conversation. And one of our goals was to, A, show them a list of 25 vacant distressed properties that Mitch McKee and his team had brought together, but then also put the question to the banks of who is attached to any of these houses. The bad news was that none of the banks that were in the room that day actually were attached to those particular houses. The good news was is that we were able to figure out some other banks that weren't invited that day who were, in fact, attached to those houses. And so one thing that I would like to emphasize is just the city's collaboration with the banks. And as we think about our first recommendation, which is better collaboration, perhaps designating an internal vacant distressed property unit or a vacant distressed property committee that would probably be comprised of the people that you heard from today or from their respective offices who are all involved on this first and foremost, and so they understand this complex policy issue, They understand the different kinds of approaches that the city is taking and can focus on this particular issue, but then also that team can be charged with maintaining something of a relationship with our external holders, such as the banks, for ongoing meetings, because that partnership is important as well. I put down the public. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Actually, I didn't print it off, so I will send it. I will send it to your offices. I apologize. Yeah. Okay. So I'll make sure that that you each get one of those. The public list idea is something that we came across down in Oakland, California, where neighbors really they were experiencing a very bad vacant distressed property problem down there. Most of them probably didn't understand the ins and outs like we've talked about today. They were just really angry, much like and quite emotional, as you can imagine from hearing testimony from Sally earlier about living next to these homes. And so what they did is they ended up really going public with the banks. And that kind of public pressure on the banks proved to be very effective in terms of raising awareness to them. And so in our research on the banks, just in terms of identifying this problem and understanding this problem, being proactive on this problem, we still think that it's not really on their radar as something that they fully understand, which is all the more reason why it's so important at the local level that we take the initiative here in Portland by having all of our offices work internally and create that system of communication and collaboration to push the needle on this. And so I put public list as one possible tool that could be used. We could post it on somewhere on our city's website that shows our ongoing top list of 25 houses and with pictures and the attached bank just to make sure that it's noticed publicly. On the second one, I want to recap our recommendations, so very quickly, better collaboration. Two is our foreclosure program. So you heard from Sarah Landis in the auditor's office. Perhaps it's the most surefire way and efficient way of addressing these homes at the local level. You heard from Zach on the receivership model, and we want to make sure that that happens, the two happening congruently. The vacant registry program is another idea, along with the list, the public list. And just having all of those working together, because this problem you heard is from the testimony, it's been here, it's still here, it's likely going to be here unless we keep collaborating and keep working actively to do something about it. And so I would recommend those.
Well, thank you. Well, yeah, let's get that out to the council. My yep. intention would be to move forward with both the foreclosure effort that's now underway and the receivership model. The list idea, interesting, we can talk about that some more. Rather publicly disclosing who we're targeting is appropriate or not, I'm less persuaded by that, frankly. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but what matters
seems
most
seems like it
is
might be advertising, hey, this place is vacant,
yeah
move
I'm
on
not
in.
Sure if that's all that helpful, but if we're actually moving forward on receivership and foreclosure on the houses themselves, to me that's the most critical piece.
I'd like to add another suggestion. Every 5 years we do an RF, a request for proposals for banks that do all our check writing and processing. Why don't we have a criteria that says you cannot have any properties on our extremely distressed property list if you want to qualify to be our lending financial services bank?
Wonderful connection. Yeah, that's great. Wait, anything else?
I think there might be some purpose in not listing the specific properties, but listing the banks with the number of properties that we've got on our list.
Okay, all right. I like that idea. Great. Well, again, thank you, colleagues. This has been a good discussion, and as you can tell, a lot of work by not just the two people in my office, but all the other folks that we've heard from today has gone into this effort. I really appreciate it. And our long-suffering police officers who've had to be in the squirrel cage on this issue, we hope that help is on the way. Thank you all very much. Thank you.